welcome to Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana, your host. Each month, we'll have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, faraway poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets, maybe even folks who are not poets. Everybody reading and talking about poetry and everything. Tonight, I'm going to add two things to the now three-month-old habit of this show. First of all, a thank you to the folks who helped with the A.M. O'Malley show in August. We had a little tiny tempest in our August teapot, and we were assisted by Aaron Yankee, Ken Jones, and Becky Myers. Thank you to those three folks who saved A.M. and me in this very studio where you are listening to us tonight. And also, a reminder, KBOO's fall membership drive just ended, but it's not too late for you to join or to re-up. Your participation is absolutely necessary for KBOO's existence, and that is not a metaphor, though this is a poetry show. That is the basic reality. So if you haven't already, or maybe even if you have already, you can still call the station and in whatever way you prefer, arrange to send or bring in some useful dollars along with your presence and your energy as a member. Okay, so as we have been doing, I will read one of my poems as the opening into the land of poetry. This one's called Once I Sat on the Side of a Mountain. Balanced on a rocky mountain in the tall Colorado heart, small pieces of mountain fell away from me, past walls of gold stone and green pine. But sky was blue all over me. Sky was blue all over me, and eagles flew under my feet. I took this to be education. I took this to the city as a dream. I took this to my bed and to my kitchen to eat it and touch it in the dark. That's my contribution for tonight, folks.
Nice contribution.
Thank you. And that was the voice of one of tonight's guests, Patty and Duane. I'm going to tell you, although many of you here in the Portland area know these folks, because they're major leaguers in the poetry world of the upper left corner of Oregon. But folks who are listening from all over the planet, or for all we know, other planets as well, will need to know this, that Duane Ponce and Patricia McLean write poetry and fiction here in Portland, Oregon, where they live in the Milepost 5 arts community. McLean's writing, poetry, short stories, and nonfiction prose, has appeared in various publications, including Windfall, The Lake, Panache, Trillium, Continental Drift, and The Green Voice. She has also written two poetry chapbooks, The Smell of God and The Lines of My Palms. Right now, Patty's working on a novel. Duane Ponce, a lifelong activist and advocacy journalist, is an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation who writes speculative fiction, fantasy, and literary mysteries, often containing Native American characters and themes. His current project is the Sweetland novels. The first volume, Skirmion, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is done. And the second and third are in progress. Together, Patty and Duane founded the nonprofit organization Alohi Gadugi, which is a Cherokee phrase meaning the world working together in community. That is an enterprise that includes 5 years of producing the poetry series Readings at Milepost 5, also including publishing a literary journal, and operating The Habit of Rainy Nights Press, one of the all-time great names of a press, which published the much-praised collection Raising Our Voices, an anthology of Oregon poets against the war. In 2003, you might wonder, the war? At the outset, that one was of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as books by individual poets. Both Duane and Patty were members of the guerrilla poetry group Roadside Bomb, another great title, performing anti-war poetry on the streets of Portland. Together, they co-authored the mystery novel Bartlett House. Sounds like Dickens, right? And The Germane Truth, an experimental web fiction. So, those folks will are right here with us tonight. Welcome. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And we're going to be a trio of readers of other folks' poems to open the show. So whichever one of you would like to start, tell us who you're reading and maybe a word or two about why you've chosen the one you've chosen and read to us.
Well, I'm going to start. I'm going to read a poem by Joe Harjo. And I think having Native American roots myself and with what's going on now with the oil pipeline in the Dakotas, I think this is an appropriate poem to read. It's called "I Am a Dangerous Woman." The sharp ridges of clear blue windows motion to me from the airport's second floor. Edges dance in the foothills of the sandias behind security guards who wave me into their gun catcher machine. I am a dangerous woman. When the machine buzzes, they say to take off my belt, and I remove it so easy that it catches the glance of a man standing nearby. Maybe that is the deadly weapon that has the machine singing, "I am a dangerous woman." But the weapon is not visible. Security will never find it. They can't hear the clicking of the gun inside my head.
Mm. Thank you. And Patty, who have you got for
okay,
us?
Okay, I have Evan Boland, who is a Irish poet, has been, I'm not sure she still is, a professor of at Stanford University, where she was a professor of English, but I don't know if she's still doing that. And I'm going to read Ceres Looks at the Morning. And, okay, here we go. I wake slowly. Already my body is a twilight, solid, cold, at the edge of a larger darkness. But outside my window, a summer day is beginning. Apple trees appear, one by one. Light is pouring into the promise of fruit. Beautiful morning, look at me as a daughter would look, with that love and that curiosity as to what she came from and what she will become.
Thank you. And I've chosen for my third of tonight's reading by other people, what I call OPW, Other People's Work, because I love to include other people's work in my own readings. Alberto Rios, who says about his work, "I want my poems and stories to serve the community in the same manner the baker's bread does." And this is the poem I've chosen, "The Dangerous Shirt." The shirt in my closet is dangerous. I shouldn't have ironed it. Because I have, I will put it on. If I put it on, I will be dressed. If I am dressed, I will be drawn toward the door. The door and not the couch, the door. Because if I am dressed, I will not want to lie down. I will not want to get wrinkled, spoiling, after all, the hard work of ironing the shirt. If I am dressed and standing at the door, I will want to go out, and I will go out, because what else can I do if I can't lie on the couch? So if I get near the door, that's it. Shake your head for me, because I will open it. And if I open it, I will go through it. I will go through it and close it behind me. The danger of the shirt, of course, always, every moment, it is so obvious. Isn't that great?
Talking about dangerous stuff tonight.
Yes, yes. Okay, well, perhaps you two have dangers embedded in the readings you're going to do for us. The next set of minutes here will be devoted to reading by Patty and Duane. First, I'll say the appropriate, this is KBOO Portland, and this show is Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana. Guests tonight are Duane Ponce and Patty McLean, who are now going to read some of their work. Now, they write both poetry and fiction. Mm-hmm. These are word people in extremis. And so whatever y'all have chosen for us, mm-hmm. and in whatever order you want to do it, take it away.
You want me to start?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I've chosen to read some of my older poetry tonight, as well as a flash fiction piece. This is called This Trail of Tears. There is a trail, comes down from the mountain. There's a fork in the trail. The trail becomes two trails, and each of these two trails branch out and so on in geometric progression. In geometric progression, so you would think, there's an infinite number of choices. There's an infinite number of choices, except for the dead ends, except for the padlocked gates and the private property, no trespassing signs, except for your gender or the color of your skin, except for the soldiers with guns who block your way, and the armies of missionaries, and the armies of bureaucrats, and the armies of teachers who tell you go this way, who tell you go this way, who tell you go that way. And when you end up here in this city without a job, without a place to sit, without a place to piss, they tell you to move on. They tell you you have no right. They tell you you have no right. They tell you you've taken the wrong road. They tell you it was your choice. They tell you you chose this trail of tears. Excuse me. This is a flash fiction piece called Futures. He had women's names tattooed across his chest. Judy, Lorette, Marlena. He traded stocks for a living and rode a Harley on weekends. And when we were together, I would wait impatiently as he slowly took off his tie and Franceschi shirt. I wanted to caress those names, wrap my fingers around the little curls of blonde hair, knead the firm muscles underneath. He would pierce me coolly with those blue eyes, his detachment inducing apprehension, then disgust, and in the end, in the excruciating end, unbelievable excitement. He would push me roughly down on the bed, the couch, the table, against the bathroom wall. He would tear at my clothes like a savage, his hands hard and abrasive against my breasts, down my body, his fingers plying me until I was sore, gasping for air. Then he would rev up his Harley and drive home his little stockbroker. Buy, sell, plunge in, withdraw, bull, bear, until the market hit a new high, then pull out exhausted. While amused, I watched his indicators plummet. As I lay there waiting for the scavengers to finish me off, he would dress, nodding his tie, he would say, next time, and walk coolly out the door. The wait would sometimes be almost unbearable. I would want him so badly to tear off his shirt, touch those names, Fran, Maggie, Dorinda, hoping to see mine there listed on the Dow, Amanda, up 2.5 points. Maybe he only added the names later, I would tell myself, when the women were fond memories, or when they proved worthy of his portfolio, I thought, disappointed. Will you have my name etched there, I asked him one day, there in that space below the left nipple. I'm moving, he said, down south. The game's stale here. Trading futures in Mexico, that's a sweeter deal. A bull market all the way. And the senoritas are pretty, I thought. Gotta leave some room for Consuela, Maria, Rosita. He thinks he can go on forever, buying low, selling high. He can barely contain that bull in his trousers. Fuck a few peasants. It's the American dream, fucking the peasants. Manifest destiny. Buy low, sell high. This is called the Ice Age. They say the Ice Age began in the heart of a CEO born on the Beltway, conceived in a cryogenic lab from the frozen sperm of J.P. Morgan and the egg of an unknown princess, carried to term in the womb of a young White House servant, a daughter of many tribes, raped repeatedly at the age of 12 by white conquistadors in three-piece suits. The only ice she ever knew was a drug to ease her pain. Like Ice Nine, the frozen crystals spread from heart to heart in the boardrooms of transnational corporations, in the beds of prostitutes and politicians, and when a glacier issued forth from the Oval Office, it was covered night and day by the Weather Channel until all the people became numb, and the remaining warmth soon fled for tropical destinations, refusing commerce with the land of ice. The Gulf Stream's cold shoulder chilled the North Atlantic, and like the wealth of empires, the ice accumulated, burying Chase Manhattan, burying Citicorp, burying the Bank of America, until the snowblind nations fell. According to careful forensic analysis, the result you see today, the mass suicide of Western civilization, was programmed into the genes, was woven into the tunics of Isabel's Christian sailors, was written in the Bible, go forth and conquer the earth. But you cannot conquer nature. You cannot conquer God. God is the ice against which your coldness pales. I dreamed Cousin Evo came down from the mountains carrying a single red rose clasped firmly in his fist, and beside him walked the ghost of Che and the ghost of El Libertador and the ghosts of the children of the mothers of the disappeared, and behind those came the spirits of the vanquished gods, Inti and Mama Kia, Pia and Makanaima, Kulamina and Kururamani, Ichchel and Votan, Yurikan and Jaluka, Selu, the corn mother, and Kanati, the hunter, child born of water and monster slayer. And after this phalange, there came the immense river of the people, the lost millions bearing the deep crimson flowers of our tears, held high into the air, millions of red flowers flowing north like a great river of blood, washing away a half millennium of history written in the language of guns and whips and disease by the cowboys and the conquistadors, sweeping before it all of the borders and all of the walls which separate us from them, from our relations. And they came dancing into our waiting arms, and the soldiers of the empire stood, mouths agape, dropping their guns, for they knew there was no holding back the flood now. And one last poem. This is called Voices in My Head. I thought about writing a poem today, but I got distracted by the noise in my head. It's a condition from which I've suffered for a very long time now, but it's become worse in recent years. You can't go anywhere these days without being bombarded, without being assaulted, insulted, and faulted. You can't walk down the street without being slammed, shammed, and spammed by corporate America, without some sap in a clown suit wagging his flag in your face, without some electronic message being jacked into your head. No, I don't have a steel plate, if that's what you're thinking. No transmissions received from alien beings. Now, where did that come from? I know you want to send me some text, tell me about the next big thing, sell me a wing-ding diamond ring, throw in some ginseng knives, toss me a bone, but I don't have that kind of phone. I can't handle one more source of information, one more convolution of elocution, institutional pollution of the mind, one more list of phony choices, no more itemized invoices, just shut up the fucking voices. That's what I want. Stop the voices. You know what I mean? It's time for the guillotine. Now, where did that come from? Most days it's under control, but you see I have these lapses, diarrhea of the synapses, need to slap some sense into the national defense, rinse my mouth with gasoline, stiffen up my spleen, if you know what I mean. It's time for the guillotine, time for some heads to roll, collect the toll that's due from their unwanted intrusion into my psychic well-being, even if it's just an illusion. Greedy bastards want to access me, then pay me my fee. Or wait, I have a better solution. It's time for revolution. Now, where did that come from?
All right, Dwayne Ponce, ladies and gentlemen. And now, mm-hmm. Patty McLean.
Okay, so first poem I'm going to read is called Sounding. She went to the tree alone, every day alone, to be there. Its branches splitting light into so many pieces, so many more pieces than she could count, if she could count. And were there not seasons there too? Did the leaves not turn red and yellow, fall to the ground? And was there not a bed of leaves, a deep, soft hummus of leaves, smelling like she imagined God smelled, like herself where her two strong legs came together? Did it frighten her when that sound came out of her mouth, when she knew she had a mouth? Or did she laugh and run, naming every flower, every butterfly and bird, until she stood in front of him and called him by name? What passed over his face she had a name for, she meant to give to the kind of night that is filled with clouds. She had named everything while he slept, everything, and nothing was left but his fear to name and his desire for a bed of leaves and the smell of God. And the next one is actually a poem from a cycle of poems that Duane and I did called Raven on 82nd Avenue. And this is one of the fun poems in it. It's called Vindication. The whole Corvid family never forgets a face. It scares the hell out of me. Suppose there's a breakdown in the machinery. Eye scans don't work. Fingerprints can't be read. There'd be crows in airports eating dirty popcorn, nesting in the bathrooms, paid with squirrel parts to perform facial recognition on terrorist scientists, guilty of reading books and predicting catastrophe. They'd make mistakes and tell lies. They'd insist on riding first class and free drinks. Before long, we would be captured and counted, and they'd set us loose with numbers scratched into the skin of our ankles like bracelets. They'd watch us through binoculars. We'd never understand a word they said. Fall 2006, deep water burning. At leaf drop, we breathe rot with every suck. Fog grips oak and chestnut, wraps trunk and branch, turns the hollows between trees into doors we could all walk through, into another life, an other death. Thousands of miles south, homeless pelicans stagger under dead-weighted wings, stumble over tarballs. Iridescent waters roll and flop. A ship cleaving the surface leaves a trail of drowned fish. And this is a pillar. There's a pillar of salt. If you travel that desert, you will see her facing the flatland. You will make a story of her. It is what you do beneath stars and moon, among friends, family, before you sleep. Create myth, send the future reeling. A mountain of salt growing by the Dead Sea is miracle enough, but the woman watching you is like the finger of God. Among all the stories, the one that slips off your swollen tongue begins like this. Sin was salt, and salt you are. You only want to say that salt, like water, is life. I ride bicycle, I commute by bicycle, and so I meet up with a lot of various things in the bike lane. This is called Roadkill. The smell of death is strong in the bike lane. Every day a squirrel or two, sometimes a possum or a raccoon. And after that first heavy rain, a few dead rats and one dead crow. Squirrels quickly become patches of leather, flattened and dried, picked clean by carrion eaters. Bigger roadkill sink bite by maggot and bacteria bite. Not roadkill. A few feet from the highway, the body of a man in a brown suit lies face up, hands at sides. Later, I will remember a hat, a fedora. A blue wagon waits for the body. Three men stand as if watching, and we ride through the Umatilla, past the gate the men did or did not pass through before he was shot. Did he fall like that, straight out? Or did the men quietly gathered there in the mild April sun make order of his death. And the last one, seating reserved. In a city too tired to complain, a commuter train courses over broken ties. Coyotes trot in the slipstream, fall back into night to familiar gleaming dark. We occupy seats temporally, aware we may be required to move for saviors and people with disappointments, or sullen teenagers repeating the same hour as yesterday. It is possible that the driver has already left the train, and we are crawling toward the end of the line in the company of no one we have ever known.
Thank you. One of the things that I am growing to love about this show is that I get what I think of as my own private performances. And of course, they're not private because all of you, as they used to say, out there in radio land are sharing this auditory experience with me. But here I am in the studio with these folks and they're reading their poetry at me, with me, for me, to me. And it's a serious kick. Thank you so much, both of you. I have, of course, now it's the interview part, questions for you. Folks who've just tuned in, don't worry, you can get the early part later. But for right now, this is KBOO Portland. The show is Poetry and Everything. And those poems definitely contained a lot of what I'm calling everything. Mm-hmm. When I thought about naming the show, I thought, well, you know, this is not just about lyricism, although it is. Mm-hmm. This is not just about rhyming a la Dwayne, for instance, but it is. It's about as much of everything as any one of us writers may choose to put in. So, some questions for you two. Mm-hmm. First of all, you're in transition these days. Mm-hmm. You've mm-hmm. made some changes. Mm-hmm. The decision to close the reading series just this past summer. Well, let's start with that. So say a few words, either or both of you, about that decision. Okay. No blame. Uh-huh. I just uh-huh. want to know, because it was a great series.
What the heck happened?
Yeah, what's that about?
Well, I have spent the last few years as the arts director at Milepost 5, and I have really... It's a volunteer job, but it was more than full time. Mm-hmm. And I had no time for my writing. So I've been trying to get out of it for a long time. and a decision was made by the owners of the building that maybe we should go in another direction. And so there were some philosophical differences. Nothing too major, but I decided this is the perfect opportunity mm-hmm. to drop out of that. Well, it turns out when I did that we lost the kind of guaranteed access to the venue. And there was that was problematic, and I was forced to cancel a couple of readings, and I just decided that it was time to get back to my writing, which mm-hmm. I've been wanting to do anyway.
Of course, so. We all say that because we really mean that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Dwayne has made really a lot of progress on his novels since then, so yes. It's really been a good decision. I think, you know, we miss the doing it to a certain extent. You know, there was a lot of great things. I really enjoyed having the poets and we had a few fiction writers as well, and it was really fantastic. But working on the novels, I mean, I think we're going to get them done.
You know? Whoa!
Which
well,
is really
us,
like,
let us not
you know,
only hope
I've been,
that, let us assume
I just,
that.
I just arrived at a point with mine where I think, wow, you know, it's going to get there. So that's really been important. And really, frankly, I don't think we could do that if we were still so involved uh-huh. In the cafe and the venue and doing the reading series. We just really needed to step back, and this was the opportunity to do that. So
yeah.
Here we are.
The graceful exit, perhaps
yeah.
under duress, but
yeah,
grace
yeah,
nonetheless.
Yeah, yeah, it was a little, mm-hmm. you know, it's a huge learning experience. And kind of, I think that the problem can be that both Dwayne and I we're interested in a lot of different things, and we want to make a difference, and we want so much to for the community we live in to be a successful, vibrant place. And you know, so we jump in, you know, mm-hmm. and give a lot of energy. And then, you know, it's like, oh, wait a minute. There isn't anything left over for other things that are hugely important to us. So.
We love doing the reading series.
Oh, it was obvious.
It was really a labor of love. And
clearly.
Yeah.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Social Justice Action Center Open House, Tuesday, October 4th, beginning at 5:30 p.m. at 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. Rents in Portland are rising, and long-term grassroots institutions are being forced out. But the Social Justice Action Center is bucking that trend. The Social Justice Action Center will be sharing their model for grassroots organizing in the heart of Portland, especially by and for marginalized communities and organizers of color. There will also be information on getting involved with the center, a silent auction, music, and much more. Again, that's the Social Justice Action Center Open House, Tuesday, October 4th, starting at 5:30 p.m. at 400 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Full Gallop, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs through Saturday, October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Full Gallop is a portrait of Diana Vreeland, who stood at the center of American style for 5 decades. As editor of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue magazines and as a member of the International Cafe Society, she chronicled the extraordinary people and events of her time. This play is a portrait of Vreeland at a turning point in her life. Again, that's Full Gallop, now through October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What about the press? Any thoughts about that for the future?
We've kind of kept that open. I don't really see. I think that the economics of independent publishing makes it very difficult. We're on a limited income. I'm on Social Security now, so I'm not bringing in any income, and it's difficult. It's all of the books we published. There was only one of them that actually broke even, and the rest of them were essentially subsidized by us.
Classic,
and,
sure.
That's quite true. Actually, two of the books.
Two of them did.
Raising Our Voices really did well. You know, it did well. It paid for itself.
And
a
got accolades statewide.
So it did well. It was an anthology. So, you know, you have a lot of people interested in it. And it was very topical. And people were you know, excited about what was going on. And then Marilyn's book, Red Dust Rising. I don't know if you know her.
Marilyn Johnston.
She's from
Salem.
She's an incredible promoter, and was on a mission with that as well to work with veterans who have PTSD, helping them to write. Get work out some of that through writing, express themselves, and that's kind of what Red Dust Rising was about. Her family struggle with her husband's PTSD. So it's a beautiful book, and she sold that well.
Another book with a really, really broad audience.
Like
the anti-war poems.
And I think probably the journal is going to continue. We've taken a little bit of a break from it for a couple of issues, but I think that it's something that's that I would like to continue. Mm-hmm. And I know Jer Colleen, who's our poetry editor, has some great ideas about doing some more kind of multimedia interactive kind of stuff, and we're kind of excited about that.
Great.
So it may go through sort of
as
an evolution.
As a fan, I'm glad to hear it. Yeah. Okay. Well, now, aside from you as the makers, the movers, you at now back to you as the writers. Mm-hmm. I found this wonderful piece, a little passage, spoken or written or both, by Wanda Coleman, the poet from California. Mm-hmm. She said this: "When I'm teaching, first we do an idea as a poem. Then we do it as a short story. Then we do it as a screenplay. Then we do it as a play. Then we do it as an essay. And it just blows their minds. I show them how you take the same material, but it's how you use it. Mm-hmm. You can go from structure to structure using the same material or the same idea." Mm-hmm. And I thought of bringing Wanda Coleman's piece in for you two because you are among the writers who do indeed write in more than one form. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, how do you choose and find? You have themes, you have ideas, you have concerns, you have topics that you want to write about. And so one of the classic questions that we all get asked, I'm now asking you, how do you make those decisions? How do you say to yourself, how is it that you come to say to yourself, okay, for this, I'm going to write a long poem in 6 parts. For this, I'm going to write short fiction. For this, and so on and so on. So talk to us about that.
That's really, I haven't ever really thought about it. Some things are stories that are complex and involve characters and place and, themes that are, you can put all of it, or I can't put all of that into a poem. It's more difficult, I think, in fiction in some ways to express that kind of essential universal moment that, I hope I arrive at sometimes in my poetry, of something that is just so, to me, poetry is a distillation, and it's the moment, it's when things, when whatever it is that's moved me is something that I can encapsulate in. And it takes a long time. It doesn't mean that it's quick. Because write it down, and then of course there's like 100, revisions. But at least for me, that's kind of how it works. But I guess sometimes things start out as a rant or start out as an idea that it is just a sort of a prose thing, and then later becomes a poem. Uh-huh. That happens.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dwayne, you want to add anything to that?
Well, I guess that
or contradict
it. Long form fiction has always sort of been my first love, and it's like I really think that the novel is my milieu.
Yeah.
I've never really considered myself a poet, although I have, there's been periods of my life when I've intensely written, particularly the last 15 years or so. And my poetry is almost always driven by social concerns.
Your choices tonight are examples
and
of that.
And my poetry tends to be narrative, and it tends to be story-like. It's not some personal deep, even though there is that, the personal is in there, it's not so much expressing that as it is expressing something that's some social concern that's on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And And I guess that with the long form fiction, it's more about world building. And I say that as a science fiction writer, that's something that is really important. But I think all fiction, mm-hmm. you know, the author is building a world, that to me is mm-hmm. what I love to do. It's mm-hmm. like it's like all that detail and putting all those pieces together, and building this thing.
That's what you get off on.
That's what I get off on.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. We want to say something to someone mm-hmm. else, but what I think about writing, or one of the many, many mm-hmm. things I think about writing, is I get off on it. Mm-hmm. It is what, you know, it's like walking in the woods mm-hmm. or standing in the sunlight mm-hmm. or looking at the river, literally a la Dylan, watching the river flow. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I want. Mm-hmm. And I can actually make it happen myself. Mm-hmm. Even before high tech, I could make it happen myself yeah. with a pencil
right,
and the
right,
back
right.
of an envelope. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk mm-hmm. about cliche, but that's reality, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
History,
it is.
But still mm-hmm. reality. Mm-hmm. Now, couple other questions then, folks. Thank you for addressing that. I loved mm-hmm. the Coleman piece, and I thought, oh, these are the perfect people to bring that mm-hmm. to. Here's one I love to ask people. What are you reading now, and why did you choose it, and what do you think about it now that you're reading it?
That's so funny. We're reading the same book right now, aren't we?
I think we are.
Yeah, we have these Kindles, so we often end up with the same book, and it's actually a murder mystery by a Finnish writer, and I like to read books by authors from other countries. I like it a lot. And we've read some books by Icelandic authors, and then this book by, what is her name?
I can't even
think of her name. Trouble with Kindle. This is my gripe about Kindle, is that you don't see the front of the book, you don't see the name at the top of the page, you don't see the name of the author, you can never remember who's written the book that you're reading. It drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons we chose it was because it is a woman from Finland that wrote it, and it's well written, but people seem these days to have this tendency to describe the meals that everybody's eating, and really not something I care about. You know, it's really kind of funny, but it is giving us a sort of a flavor of Finland.
Uh-huh. Not, mm-hmm. And is it in translation, or did this person write in English?
It's in translation.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And the translator for this book is way better than the translator for the Icelandic ones.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, since you bring that part up, I guess I need to, because I'm about to ask you another question about that, about translation. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of thoughts and actually emotional responses mm-hmm. to the act of translation and the fact of translation. Mm-hmm. So when we're reading something, quote unquote, in translation, are we really reading something by the person who wrote it in the original language? I think no, we're not. Mm-hmm. We're reading something by the translator. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that that's not the same thing. And when I have mm-hmm. done translation, the only language I ever got good enough in to do this with is Spanish, mm-hmm. although I'm certainly not that good anymore. But for a while, one brief mm-hmm. shining moment, mm-hmm. as they say, I could really do it. Mm-hmm. And what I wrote in English was not what that woman had written in Spanish, yes. but was literally translated by me. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't trying to change what she wrote. I'm not saying that other translators are trying to change it. I'm saying that it's never the same thing. What do you guys think about that?
Right. Yeah,
what's your thinking about that?
I tend to agree with you on that. I think that there are so many subtleties of another culture that are very very difficult to translate, and some that's not just in concepts, but in language. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, the best translators are also novelists or poets themselves. Mm-hmm. And I want them to translate in a way that will immerse me in that culture, but also be something that I can comprehend. I think there's a lot of bad translators out there.
Indeed.
Particularly in the genre fiction. We are one of our guilty pleasures, as we've already revealed, is reading murder mysteries, and we tend to read a lot of Scandinavian murder mysteries, particularly. And one of the things I've noticed is that the translations are often translated by British authors, and there's a lot of Britishisms in it. And I think a good literary translator would avoid that. It's
not bring in the flavor of yet another culture.
Yet another culture right, into it. Right. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And of course, we don't notice so much when they're using Americanisms because it's kind of invisible to us, but it really stands out when somebody's using British expressions that we think of that is just used in Britain. Uh-huh. I think it's true that translations are not the book, they're not the original in any way, but they do carry, there's still the mark. Definitely.
Oh, yes.
The mark of the original writer. Yes. On them, so that you find that over and over again, like Saramago is definitely has this style that the translator is reproducing in some way.
Uh-huh.
And that's unmistakable in all the books that I've read, and I think they're by different translators. I'm going to go look and see if they are. I've read several of his books, and I think, I wish that I knew Polish, because my favorite poet is Wisława Szymborska. I wonder, what's it like?
Right.
What is she really saying? What is it like to read her
in Polish
and understand it?
Yeah.
And what are the subtleties that maybe aren't there? What's embedded in the culture that I'm not,
And
I'm
the
not
sound,
receiving.
The
yeah,
music
the sound
of it. The music of the language is so different. And again, I want to say, I'm not dissing it. I love it. I'm so grateful to translators. But as Duane said, they have to be good writers.
Right.
This is not about finding a word in the dictionary and saying, okay, this one is the same, as if such a thing could even exist in the world.
Right. Yeah.
We want those people to be really, really, really good writers so that they can give us whatever is possible to give us from what the original had in it. Well, I have one more question before we run out of time tonight. And it's another of that sort. Mm-hmm. What writers do you believe have been influential and or in some other way really important to you as writers?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly writers, for instance, A.A. Milne has been really important to me because I'm a Winnie the Pooh person. that's one of the elements of my character. Mm-hmm. I am a Pooh person. However, I don't think that Milne has been a serious influence on my writing, whether in poetry or in prose. Mm-hmm. So that's, one way or another. What have you got for that one?
I'll start. I think back about childhood, and the first book that I remember from my childhood is A Child's Garden of Verses, which is by Robert Louis Stevenson, and I still have it, and it's just really a wreck, but I was entranced by those poems, and I was like 5 or 6 years old, and So that was kind of my introduction to poetry. And so throughout my life, I've, you know, it, from my childhood, you know, I went from one poet to another, and I loved the Rime of the Ancient Mariner and tried to memorize it at one point.
That's
but
big.
Of course, it was crazy. You can't.
The rappers
can't really
can do
that. Yeah, probably. Yeah. And, you know, so there were various people. I think that I tend to a little towards magical realism in my writing. And so Kafka, Gabriel Garcia Marquez says Kafka is like your first magical realist. And I love Kafka. I don't know, a lot of people have been influences on me. Saramago's been an influence. I just, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who's, who have influenced me, and I almost hate to call out certain ones because there's so many, and Ursula Le Guin has influences me too in, her historical novels and, particular, so anyway. I'll let you talk for a minute.
Well, I think the writers who have influenced me the most have been Doris Lessing, for one. I love her Children of Violence
hugely
series.
Important.
And I like some of her later stuff too. But her science fiction too. I think it's great, and I think that she was one of the early literary writers that really really grabbed me. I also Ursula Le Guin, I have to say, has been like my inspiration. I have always wanted to be able to write as well as she can write.
That's a good goal. If you got to have a goal, that sounds like a reasonable. Let's try that.
And I've been really influenced by a number of early. I grew up on science fiction, and I discovered socially conscious science fiction at a very young age, and. Authors like Brian Aldiss and John Brunner were just they opened my eyes to things and ideas that I never would have had without having read them, and I was really influenced by Joanna Russ and some of the early feminist science fiction in the 70s. Some of the current science fiction authors that I think are just marvelous are Charles Stross and Ian MacDonald are two writers that I really think a lot of. Literary authors, there are so many. Patrick Chamoiseau,
too many to even think of.
Yeah.
My fallback position is to say that I'm deeply influenced by Shakespeare. Yeah. And it's the truth,
right.
You know.
It's so true.
It's not false in any way.
Yeah.
And it
just
it is a conversation stopper, I know.
Yes.
But at least it gets me in the door, you know.
Yeah.
I'm paying attention to what the man had to say.
Yeah.
No question. All right. Well, thank you both very much for being part of the show, this series that we are now doing, episode 3, so to speak, of Poetry and Everything. And folks, next month in October, our guest will be Judith Barrington, another Portland word woman. So be sure that you sign up for that one in your calendar books, online or otherwise. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with Poetry and Everything in October. Good night.